The interviewer sticks the mic in his face and goes, "Oh, Mr. Rooney, you're just such a piece of Hollywood history. It's just you've been in Hollywood longer than the Hollywood sign." And Mickey Rooney says, "Well, you know why it says Hollywood up on the hill, don't you?" And this kid goes, "No." And Mickey goes, "Well, because."
Welcome to The Art in Yourself. I'm John Lister, and this is part two of my two-part conversation with the king of the hyphens, Paul Strohle, actor, writer, director, producer, graphic artist. This conversation also includes a very strange and unexpected deep dive into everything Paul and I know about Mickey Rooney. I've noticed in the films that you've done, or at least the films that I've seen that you've done, that the characters that you do have something else going on. There's something else behind that. There's a scene at the end of Wake where you light a cigarette and you put that cigarette out after one puff. And this is going to sound completely sycophantic, and I certainly don't mean it to, because you know I don't respect you. But there's like so much that happens that has nothing to do with anything other than just that this character has a life and we're seeing it, even though we don't get to see it. That character's in like four scenes and we don't even know who the guy is really.
Right.
But there's like so much else going on there. And in The Beating, which is a disturbing film to begin with, there's so much more going on there that just makes it fascinating to watch. Do you find yourself, because you are a writer as well as an actor, do you find yourself writing those moments so that they seem more complete as an actor, even though there is no dialogue?
Well, you know, I love the, well, The Beating, it was weird because Wake, that was a role that was written for me. And The Beating I wrote, The Beating, the short film, I wrote that one. And I sort of, I like the idea of the duplicity of that character, the depth of, you know, having someone who really is hiding something throughout. And, you know, as an actor too, it's such a joyous thing to play when you have, you know, so many different levels, you know, the great unspoken. It's just so joyous to kind of mind that. And also if that's really taking place in your mind, you know, the more subtext and levels you have to, you know, in this case, the darkness of the character, the less opportunity you have to be fake, you know, because you have so much, so many layers going on in your head. And the, I don't know if I'm making sense with this, but the idea of that duplicity, like Tom Waits once said, I'm a huge Tom Waits fan. And Tom Waits once said, I love beautiful melodies telling me terrible things."
Oh, wow!
And I just love that. I love that whole, you know, concept of, you know, what something is on the surface isn't necessarily what's actually going down. And it really evidenced by The Beating, which you can't really go into detail about because
that's the hard thing. I was trying to figure out how I could talk about that film, and I really can't without giving away that film.
Yeah. It's boy, that was a,
I ignorantly hadn't realized that you'd written that. It's a great piece. It's disturbing in a lot of good ways.
Oh, well, hey, thank you. That's what we were shooting for. It's a, I can tell people what the premise of it is. It's about bullying, and it's about a father who is sort of driven to his wits' end because of a very, very difficult bullying situation at his son's school. And that's online. People can see that one. I think it's on Vimeo or something. I just got to look up The Beating. We had great success with that with film festivals. You know, short films, they don't make any money. Short films are sort of your advertisement for, you know, a lot of times, unfortunately, they become your advertisement for your feature because there's, I mean, they're not, that they're not their own amazing art form, and some of the best things I've seen have been short films, but you don't make short films to make money, I guess is my point.
Right.
And, but, we did very well on the festival circuit with the beating, but what was very off-putting, John, and I got to tell you, this was very, very troubling, is that we had a certain point of view. I had a certain point of view when I wrote it about who the bully is and who the protagonist is and who the antagonist is and all of that. And it's very troubling when you're at a film festival and people start commenting on how much they loved your statement and their description of your statement is actually the opposite of your intention.
Especially knowing what your statement was in that film, the opposite would be truly disturbing.
It is. So that's a very some very touchy talkbacks because, you know, how do you look at someone who is just watched your film and really enjoyed it, but enjoyed it for all the wrong reasons because they think you're a proponent of certain opinions and points of view simply because the characters in your film say certain things. And it's just like, no, I don't believe this. I don't think this is right. This is a story that we're telling about some very, very troubled people. And when you get people in the audience who are like siding with the troubled people and going, go team, it's like, oh, look at the time.
It's the career that Carol O'Connor had. He ran into people constantly who would pat him on the back and say, you know, thank you for giving Archie a voice and thank you for saying the things that you say. And he could not have been more diametrically opposed to Archie Bunker. And he saw it as what it was, pointing out the ignorance of that character.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. People didn't see that.
Him, and also, what's that Peter Boyle movie? Bill? You know that movie, Bill?
Bill was Mickey Rooney.
Okay, there was some movie with Peter Boyle as like a right-wing, extreme, like Archie character. I think it was just like A Man's Name or something. I don't remember, but it was exactly that too. I mean, you couldn't get more. I mean, I think, you know, Peter Boyle was like slightly left of Lenin. Exactly.
So was Carol O'Connor.
And by Lenin, I mean that Lenin, but also a lot of people don't know this. Peter Boyle was John Lennon's best man.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a hippie, you know? And I wish I could think of the name of the film, but exactly that. Same thing with the Carol O'Connor thing. He was just like mortified. Joe, that's the movie. Joe.
Ah, yeah. Gotcha. I don't know that one.
So, anyway, but you knew Bill, boy. You knew Bill Mickey Rooney, man. You pulled that out of the air. I'm impressed.
One of my favorite things that Mickey Rooney ever did was an infomercial that he did with his wife towards the end of his career and his life. And there's a scene in it in which Mickey is in the background in their kitchen, in quotation marks, washing his hands, thinking that the sink is not actually in the frame. It is. There's no water at all. But Mickey does a hell of a job for a good solid minute washing his hands in no water and then shaking them and turning off the tap. He just goes for it. I got to respect that.
I heard a great story about Mickey Rooney. I don't know if it's true, but Someone was interviewing him on live television, and he was, you know, I think he was at the time he was doing Sugar Babies or something, and once again, I don't know if this is true, but I pray to God it is because it's just brilliant. The interviewer sticks the mic in his face and goes, "Oh, Mr. Rooney, you're a piece of Hollywood history. It's just you've been in Hollywood longer than the Hollywood sign." And Mickey Rooney says, "Well, you know why it says Hollywood up on the hill, don't you?" And this kid goes, "No." And Mickey goes, "Well, because dirty, rotten, backstabbing motherfuckerville didn't fit."
Yeah, I want that to be true as well.
I don't know if it's true, but God, I want it to be true.
No, it's true. It's got to be.
And when I was doing Laughter on the 23rd floor at the Briar Street Theater here in Chicago. And once again, to the Mickey Rooney people, I don't know if this is true, but the stage manager.
Yeah, I don't want to be sued by the Mickey Rooney estate when they listen to this podcast.
So allegedly, we'll just say allegedly. Okay.
Thank you.
But the stage manager for Laughter on the 23rd Floor, I don't remember the woman's name. She was very, very kind, very sweet. She had also stage managed Lend Me a Tenor at the Apollo when Lend Me a Tenor ran forever. And Mickey Rooney played a role in Lend Me a Tenor there. I think it was there. And he wouldn't change his pants. He forgot to change his pants in the last scene. So he had blue pants on. And then in the last scene, he was supposed to be in a tuxedo and he would only put the jacket on. So he would come out and he would have a tuxedo jacket on and the blue pants from the previous scene. So the stage manager had to keep telling him, Mr. Rooney, you have to make sure that you change your pants as well, you know, or it just doesn't look right because you're just wearing the blue pants. And he got angry with her and he turned around and he, how should I put this, waved his lad in her general direction.
whipped out Andy Hardy.
Exactly. And I asked her, what did you do? And she said, God love her. She goes, I didn't really do anything because all I could think was, hey, that was in Ava Gardner.
Exactly. How often do you get to see, you know, a piece of Hollywood history?
Exactly.
Okay, last alleged Mickey Rooney story here. I was working with someone who worked with Mickey Rooney years ago, and I think it was at Candlelight. They would bring in, you know, a ringer, a star for the show, and the cast would rehearse the show until sort of a week before opening, and then they would bring in that ringer. And in this case, it was Mickey Rooney. And the week prior to them bringing in Mickey Rooney, Mickey's representative came in, and they had a cast meeting. Where the representative went through every page of the script and told them at what point the cast would break character and start laughing because they simply couldn't control themselves because Mickey was that funny. So there were prearranged places so the audience would think that Mickey was so funny the cast couldn't keep a straight face.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, it's just sad.
Oh, that hurts my soul.
Doesn't it? It's just...
Oh. Well, and it doesn't hurt my soul because, I mean, it doesn't, it's not like it's, he was so ridiculously funny and he was so
talented.
It's like, how sad to reach a point in your career where you question your own ability so much that you have to shill for, you know, well, you know, actually Bill Murray talks about that in that book about Saturday Night Live, Ladies and Gentlemen, Saturday Night, talks about when Milton Berle was on. And
That was a nightmare. That was the worst episode
yes,
ever, right?
Yes. And and Milton Berle said to Bill Murray, he said, during this scene, during, you know, whatever, Bill Murray wasn't in it. He said, drop something backstage, like drop something right behind the flat that I'm on. So it registers and people hear it. So Bill Murray was like playful and playing along. So Milton Berle's doing a scene and, you know, Murray drops a stage weight or something backstage to make some noise. And Milton Berle just goes, oh, NBC just dropped another show. Like, He had stunted the off the cuff ad lib, you know, and it's just like, why?
Is that what the business makes you? I mean, I always wondered, did Mickey Rooney even know that his assistant was coming there and doing that? Or did he genuinely think I'm so funny?
Wow. That's a good point, John. That's a good point. It was this particular worker so... You know, it made
aware of his insecurities.
Aware of his insecurities that he was already feeding that dragon. Wow. Oh, thanks for making it even darker. It wasn't dark enough.
So, death.
That's my next play, actually. Death, not so bad.
Why did we decide to just pick on Mickey Rooney for six straight minutes? How did that happen?
No. Well, you know, these are just, you know, the great stories, you know, they're like the Peter O'Toole and, Richard Harris stories and the George Bernard Shaw and the Churchill stories. They're just great, the little theater gems, you know. They're always fun to relive, you know.
I saw Peter O'Toole do the Pygmalion at the Shaftesbury Theatre in London in 1984. It was a matinee, and he was so drunk. It was glorious.
Oh, really?
Just glorious. Really? Oh. Yeah, he was in a different show than the rest of that cast. And you could tell they all knew he was in a different show, and they were just up there hoping to God the plates stayed on the sticks.
Oh, just, you know, I mean, it's – that's – That time will never happen again. I don't know if it's good or bad. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine about the famous Churchill correspondence with George Bernard Shaw about Arms and the Man. Do you know that one?
I don't.
When the Arms and the Man opened in London, part of the protocol was you always had to invite the Prime Minister, you know, as for the opening night, you know, for big
no
events
pressure.
Like that. Yeah. And apparently Shaw hated Churchill and Churchill hated Shaw. So they sent a note to the Prime Minister, and dear Prime Minister, please accept my invitation to attend the opening night of my show, Arms and the Man, at the London's Haymarket or whatever. And I'm leaving two tickets at the box office. And so feel free to bring a friend if you have one. and Churchill wrote back, "Dear Mr. Shaw, unfortunately, I will not be able to attend opening night of your play, Arms and the Man, but I will attend a subsequent performance if there is one." Just, once again, don't know
brilliant.
If it's true, but please God, let it be, you know?
You know, we don't do witty repartee the way they used to.
No, we don't. We don't. Well, we're trying here. Let's see, this is it, John. I'm not interesting enough. So half of this podcast is me telling stories about people who are wittier than I am. It's not a difficult thing to do.
Most of whom have been dead for at least 20 years.
Good point.
I came across a quote in Wake, actually, watching it, that struck me, and I think it's something that probably you had nothing to do with. I mean, you didn't write that piece, but the quote is, "Winning isn't the point. The point is playing the game." Yeah. It's what the grandmother says towards the end when she finds out that she won the lottery. Yeah. In our discussions here about what Mickey Rooney's career became, what Milton Berle's career became, it seems to me that to keep going in our business and to keep doing what we're doing, that kind of has to be the truth. The winning isn't the point. The point is playing the game.
Very much so. And to go back to when I was talking earlier about when I talk to young actors, when I speak to young actors, and also what you said earlier about the idea of creating a lot of my own work by writing, you know, films and plays and other things. I always tell young people that, you know, don't just define yourself as a creative person. Don't define yourself as an actor or whatever, because you could have a hell of a lot more to offer than you think you do. It's one of the reasons I don't write with an outline at all. Because, you know, you put an outline down and then you start writing to an outline and you've totally hobbled yourself. You're totally tethered to something. And the greatest shit is found outside of that outline. I mean, look at what you're doing, John. I listen to these podcasts and this is just something you just started a short time ago. But you're a natural with this. This is really, I mean, it's like I like these podcasts for the same reason I used to love the Bob Costas show. I love the Dick Cavett show because it's about talking to the person. It's not about a person that has something to sell or, oh, I have a film coming out and I got to go on Leno with this or whatever. You talk to people and you get and they're genuine conversations and you're like you're very good at getting this, great stuff out of people that's just interesting and, you know.
Well, it's about fucking time that you read the highlighted part of the cards.
Well, this is in bold, so I gotta do this. You used a whole different font for this.
This is not Times New Roman.
No, this is, you know, this is not. This is,
this, this is Helvetica, my friend. I'm not fucking around.
Gothic.
This is Courier. Come on now.
I didn't
well, that's
know.
That's very, very, very.
I didn't know fonts could go to 400 points. I thought we stopped at 280.
Yeah. It's very, very kind of you to say that. And, you know, the majority of the people that I've talked to on this podcast are a result of my wife having had more of a career than I have and knowing a lot of people. And I've met a lot of people through Laura. And honestly, one of the most wonderful aspects of knowing Laura is having to be in a position where I've gotten to meet you and Monica, because, you know, we've been talking now for a little over an hour, and I think people will understand that you're an erudite, intelligent, funny, wonderful man, but your wife is hell of a lot better than you are.
Well, I mean, and right back at you with that. yeah. You know, I've known Laura.
No question.
I've known Laura a lot longer than I've known you, and I really prefer that. no, Laura's just, you know, Laura and I, just like, you know, our journeys have taken us different places, but it's sort of like, you know, the value and the weight of a great friendship, because, you know, a minute back with Laura, talking to Laura, having a meal, coming to your house, you know, it's like those friendships where it's like no time has elapsed. And she's just such a dear, holds such a dear place in both of our hearts, Monica and mine, and your great kids. These are the gifts we get as we get older. These are this is what we have, you know.
I think it's also the point of what we do. One thing that I've noticed over this past year plus with COVID is I don't so much miss the work. I don't miss the memorization. I don't miss the rehearsals. I don't miss getting on stage. I would love to do it. But what I do miss is being in the rehearsal room with those people. And I miss being in the dressing room with people and having those conversations, because we're in a profession where we are constantly surrounded by fascinating and startlingly intelligent, quick people. And it just keeps you going, I think.
Oh, yeah. And it's just, there's just such a, I mean, you do a show with someone and you've shared a level of trauma. There's a camaraderie of shared trauma there, because, you know, it's pure vulnerability, you know, to go up there. I mean, to do it right, you know, there's a friendship and a bond there that just, you know. When I was on the road with the one-person show, that was something I was completely unprepared for. I was ready for 8 o'clock. I was not ready for 7:30.
Oh, that would be so weird. It was just you and a stage manager.
It's horrible. And it's just, you have 7:30, and you go up at 8, and you're like, I am 100% responsible for everyone's evening.
No, thank you.
I am, you know, and all you can think about in that last half hour is how do I not fuck this up, you know? And so when you talk about what you miss in terms of the people and the kinship and the funny stories and all of that, I'm looking forward to that as much as you know, just actually getting out there and getting on the stage. You know, that's just as important to me too.
I agree completely. And, you know, not to force a point here, but in this career, I think you're not going to last very long if winning is the point. You know, the point is playing the game, because there's absolutely no winning. I don't know anybody who hasn't succeeded in this business who doesn't think that there's another level that they haven't reached yet.
Well, yeah. And now, you know, I used to make a joke about this when I lived in LA. I used to say success in this industry is that if the number of people that you envy is less than the number of people who envy you.
Yeah, but it'll still never be zero.
But it'll never be zero, yeah. No, and I think you're right. I think there is no winning, but you know, what do you accomplish if you've won? You know, Leonard Cohen once said, he goes, My life didn't get interesting until I stopped expecting to win. He said, when I stopped making myself the masterpiece, and I started thinking about where I fit in the big masterpiece, that's when my life got interesting. And this is a discovery that he made in his like 50s, you know.
Sure.
So I always took that to heart. I always loved the sound of that. You know, I think that's sort of like what you're touching on.
Well, you're definitely someone who I think has managed to establish a career, but not just a career. It's a career with polish.
Well, you know, polish it up there. Polish that bad boy in.
See what I did there? I brought it full circle.
That's what we call a callback in the industry.
I adore you, and I can't thank you enough for doing this. I really appreciate you being a guest on The Art in Yourself. You were so helpful when I was starting this process, and you did so many things that people will never know when it came to telling me how to do this and what to do. And you designed the cover art with your Touchstone graphic design. You're a gifted graphic designer, and you really helped me get this off the ground, and I can't thank you enough for everything.
Well, and you're welcome, and of course I'm honored to do it, but the honor and what I love the most is listening to the podcasts and being like, see, I told him he was good at this, and now he is.
Well, my love to Monica, and the four of us will have to get together and have a Mickey Rooney Film Fest.
Yes, please do. Yes, let's plan that. A pleasure talking to you, John. Thank you so much for having me on. It was a real joy talking to you.
Thank you, my brother. The Art in Yourself is produced at Double Vanity Studios. Cover art by Touchstone Graphic Design. Cover photo by Joe Mazza at Brave Lux. Theme song by JQN Musique. I'm John Lister. I'll talk to you later.